Welcome to Earth Matters here on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic, Executive Director of Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. My guest today is essayist and author Philip Connors. Many of us know Phil locally as a columnist with the Silver City Daily Press and as a fire lookout in the Black Range in the Gila National Forest. He wrote about his experiences and reflections in the prize-winning book, Fire Season, Field Notes from a Wilderness Lookout, published by Echo Books. His new book, All the Wrong Places, is a memoir that recounts his relationship with his brother and his struggles to cope with Dan's suicide as he pursued his writing career. It's been a busy few months for Phil. He's just returned from a 4,000-mile multi-city tour for his new book. And earlier this year, he spent several weeks in Michoacán, Mexico, learning about the plight of the monarch butterfly. Phil will be returning to the tower soon for his 14th fire season, keeping watch over the Gila National Forest. Welcome, Phil.
Thanks, Allison. Good to be with you.
Thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule for talking with us today. So every year, 100 million North American monarch butterflies head south for the winter, traveling 3,000 miles or more from the U.S. and Canada to central Mexico forest to hibernate. Over the past three decades, their numbers have plummeted by more than 90%. Phil, you had an opportunity to go to Michoacán earlier this year to learn more about the plight of the monarch. Tell us why you went and what you learned.
Yeah, I went in part because I grew up on the northern end of that incredible migration that you mentioned on a farm in southern Minnesota. And I remember as a child going out into our soybean fields and pulling milkweed by hand. This was when it was still done that way, back in the late 70s. Later, we started using herbicides. We would take Roundup, an early version of it, and put it in little spray bottles. And we would walk the fields and we would spray the weeds directly, you know, point-to-point contact with the weeds and the herbicide. And so growing up there and seeing the evolution of our chemicals and the way that we managed weeds in that kind of farming in the upper Midwest, I felt almost in a way like I had blood on my hands, to be blunt about it. I had personally, you know, I was a kid at the time. I didn't know what I was doing. A lot of people didn't know what they were doing, but one thing we were doing was reducing the habitat of monarch butterflies. And so having grown up there and seen that evolution, you know, later on we would move through the fields on tractors with a big I-beam welded to the front of it, and there were swivel chairs welded to the I-beam. And we all had these big guns, these spray guns, and the guns were attached by hose to a giant tank in the back of the tractor, and we would drive through and just sort of assassinate weeds with these spray guns of Roundup. So I saw that evolution happening as a kid in the 70s and 80s, and I just was very curious to see the other end of their great migration and to see what kind of challenges the monarchs faced there in Mexico.
Right. So let's talk a bit about the annual migration of monarchs. This is something unique to the animal kingdom. And you, as you said, grew up at the northern end of that migration between northern part of the United States into Canada, and then the southern end being central Mexico. So tell us more about the annual migration. I mean, it's like millions of butterflies doing this, but it's not the same butterfly that's doing the whole trip, right?
Right. Yeah, it's an incredible natural phenomenon. An insect that has a migration of 3,000 to 4,000 miles one way. And of course, the insect makes that round trip every single year. But as you point out, it's not one insect doing the whole round trip. It takes multiple generations of the monarch to reach the northern end of its migration. And then, you know, it can take up to four generations, basically. So let's start where I was in Mexico. You have these monarchs who overwinter there in colonies, and they cluster on typically oyamel fir trees, a specific type of tree in the mountains of Michoacán. And as it warms up in the spring, they begin moving north, and they start breeding and laying eggs. And those eggs become pupa and larva. We've all probably seen at some point a monarch caterpillar. It has a very distinct pattern of bright green, black, and yellow stripes. And those feed on milkweed, and then they form a chrysalis, and out of that emerges the monarch. And it takes three or four successive generations of those to get from Michoacán, funneling up through central Texas, and then some continue more straight northerly toward where I grew up in Minnesota and southern Canada, west of the Great Lakes. Others end up east of the Great Lakes, and it does take those four generations. And then one generation makes the entire trip back. So that generation lives, you know, as much as four times longer than one of the short-lived generations moving north. And there is so much about the migration that still remains unknown. It's this mysterious, rather beautiful, unique natural phenomenon that people are more and more trying to study to figure out how it happens. How do they find their way back to the same tiny little colonies? By tiny, I mean, you know, the space they occupy in the mountains of Michoacán. And how do they transmit that knowledge over the course of multiple successive generations to always come back to the same place? It's a truly amazing natural phenomenon. And of course, like many amazing natural phenomenon, it's imperiled for many reasons.
Right. So you were there in late December through, I'm not sure when you came back, March or so, February?
Well, I was there. I was in Mexico during the month of January, and I spent about a week and a half, actually, in the butterfly reserve area. So I was there in mid-January, which was about the peak of the gathering of butterflies in Michoacán. It's actually kind of on the border of Michoacán and Mexico State.
So when you say the peak of gathering, they are completing their hibernation, or they're just where are they in their sort of phase? They're getting ready to take off and head north at that point, or where are they in that January time frame?
They're sort of in the middle of their time they spend in Mexico. Typically, they would arrive there around Dia de los Muertos. And there's a tradition among native people there of recognizing the return of the butterfly around the Day of the Dead.
Early November 1st.
Right, exactly, November 1st. Mm-hmm. They begin arriving back in Mexico. And it was thought by native people that was the souls of their departed ancestors returning to revisit them.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. People sometimes say these colonies were discovered in 1975 by researchers. And, you know, that's sort of a typical thing. The people who lived there forever knew about this. They had developed legends about it and stories about it. What we're really saying is that, you know, North American scientists learned about these colonies in 1975. But yeah, they slowly gather there starting in November, and they reach peak numbers after the first of the year, and they cluster in these trees. They cluster to preserve energy, to preserve moisture in their bodies, and to stay warm overnight, because they have come a long way from Canada or northern U.S., as you've mentioned, and they will be the generation that starts the relay north and will breed to create another generation as they move northward on their migration.
So one question I have is, they call it a hibernation, but is it, you know, a certain number of weeks that they're just clustered in these trees, or is it just at night that they're clustering, but they're still sort of flying around during the day? How does that work?
Yeah, to call it a hibernation, which many people do, isn't exactly accurate given what I saw. You know, they cluster overnight on these fir trees, but once the sun gets overhead, you know, late morning or around noon, they do fly around and they seek food sources and water, and then they return to those trees once the day starts to cool off again. So they have periods of activity at peak warmth during the afternoon.
And you have an absolutely amazing video on your website, very short, of you sitting on a log with hundreds and hundreds of monarchs fluttering around you as you're writing. It's very beautiful. That must have been tremendous to experience.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if I've ever experienced something more beautiful, and off the top of my head, I can't think of what that would be. To be sitting, you know, at 10,000 feet above sea level up in the mountains. We rode to one of the places on horseback, 2-hour horseback ride, and to get there and just sit while literally thousands and thousands of butterflies fly all around you, it's sublime. It's one of the most beautiful things I have ever seen, if not the most beautiful.
Wow. And when do the butterflies start to leave Michoacán to head north? What time of year?
They should be heading north about now.
Okay.
It starts to happen in late February and into March, so they'll be moving north even as we speak.
So a good 2-3 months that they're in Mexico.
Correct.
Roughly.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll be right back with more here on Earth Matters after this short break, and we'll talk more with essayist and author Phil Connors about monarch butterflies. Back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Sibick, Director of the Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. My guest today is essayist and author Phil Connors, and we've been talking about the plight of the monarch butterfly and some of Phil's insights from his recent trip to Mexico. So, Phil, the population of monarchs has dropped 96.5% over the past few decades, from an estimated 1 billion monarchs in the mid-1990s to just 35 million in early 2014. I mean, it's just unbelievable. The Fish and Wildlife Service is now reviewing the monarch status and could list the species as endangered. So what are some of the threats to monarchs? And did you see any of these threats in your trip to Mexico? You've already talked about you being a personal threat to monarchs as a kid, but
yeah.
What are some of the other threats?
Yeah, so what we saw in Mexico were threats that, you know, the threats are all about habitat, basically, on its entire migration. So in Mexico, the habitat is very clustered high in the mountains north of Mexico City, about 100 kilometers, and there, the chief threats are illegal logging and habitat loss of the forest where it overwinters. And we talked to people doing numerous things to try to deal with that. It's very complex there because there are a lot of land use and land ownership complexities. There's a biosphere preserve that is meant to protect the habitat of the monarch. It's about 140,000 acres. Parts of it around the edges have more latitude in how they can be used by local peoples. There's a core that's more protected. And the chief thing there is that people made a living off those forests for generations. And they did it often by logging those fir trees and turning them into furniture and other things that could be sold or used in households. And now, you know, it's recognized that that sort of logging is a threat. You can't cut down the whole forest and preserve the monarch there. So people are trying to do different things to change the culture and to move to more sustainable agricultural methods because in addition to logging, the major way people make a living there is subsistence agriculture. One thing that's has driven habitat loss there is our incredible appetite for avocados, it turns out, because a huge number of the avocados we eat here in America are grown in the forests of Michoacán and the state of Mexico. So, you know, if for somebody looking to make a living, you remove their ability to log because you want to preserve this habitat for the monarch. Well, they have to do something else. And in some cases, that means moving to avocado farming, planting orchards. And, of course, that could also be an incentive to cut down forest, clear forest, to start an avocado farm. So there are people working to try to make sure that the agriculture that's expanding there isn't impacting the monarch habitat. And that's, you know, tricky because of land ownership issues. A lot of the land is owned by ejidos, these communal land organizations. And so you have a lot of stakeholders involved. Some ejidos are being very progressive. They even have people, you know, as a fire lookout in the Gila, I was astonished to learn that they have lookouts in these mountains in Michoacán where what they're looking out for is illegal logging. And there have been lookouts there who have actually been killed because they discovered illegal logging and the people doing it didn't want to be discovered. And so lookouts there, you know, their lives are actually at stake. So that's one of the things we noticed, just the vast areas that have been turned into avocado orchards, and it's continuing to grow, and they're trying to do it in a way that doesn't impact the monarch.
Mm. Are there monarch-safe avocados that you can buy? Is there, like, other sort of labeling efforts? This is the first I've heard, actually, of avocados being, increased demand for avocados actually driving clear cutting down there. That's amazing.
Yeah, I didn't know that before I got there either. And it's hard because there is no way to know where your avocados come from. Hmm. You could be buying an organic Mexican avocado that was grown in a place where forest was cleared to plant that orchard. So you might think you're doing the right thing, but it's really hard to know. And so most of the effort has to happen on the ground there because as consumers so far removed from the sources of much of our food, how do we know? Mm-hmm. You know, how can we source that? We really can't.
Now, is it the Mexican government that is responsible for some of the enforcement of what's happening on the biosphere reserve, or are there nonprofits or community groups? How what did you find?
All of
the
above, basically. Yeah. You have World Wildlife Fund is involved, various non-governmental organizations, the government itself, and local community organizations. Like I mentioned, the ejidos trying to take some responsibility and keeping watch and letting it be known that illegal logging won't be tolerated. And there's also, you know, just an education element involved. We visited a guy who has an education facility in the town of Sitakuro, which is the biggest town nearby the reserve. And what he's doing is trying to teach children about the life cycle of the monarch. And so he has a yard where he shows all stages of the monarch's life cycle, from egg to butterfly. And he brings in children and he talks about the monarch and its importance, and just trying to get children excited about the monarch, and then to inculcate in them a sense of ownership and responsibility for its, you know, its continuing survival. And this guy, it was an amazing story, because we went to his facility and he had to rebuild after an arson attack, because he's been very outspoken about illegal logging. He's seen some of it himself firsthand and taken pictures, posted it to Facebook, and tried to use social media to gain awareness for it. And people didn't like that, some people. So they came to his education center and burned down all his buildings. And he got a grant from the Mexican government to rebuild that facility and keep going with his efforts. But that's, you know, a sign of the challenges you face if you try to advocate on behalf of the monarch in communities where illegal logging is still happening.
Right. So I'm interested in terms of what the Mexican government is doing to really make the Biosphere Reserve a true reserve. And so are there fines imposed on people caught illegal logging? And then also, are there government programs maybe for ecotourism or things that can provide economic development, so to speak, sustainable development to these communities who live there, but at the same time protect these areas for the monarch? What's happening?
Yeah, our sense was that the Mexican government isn't really the one entity in charge of handing out fines or trying to prevent illegal logging. It really has to happen in the communities. We heard stories, actually, of people who had been caught illegally logging, and the ejido dealt with that by taking their vehicle to the town center and burning it.
Wow.
Making a public display of the illegal activity as a just sort of disincentive.
Shame, and you lose your vehicle, too. Your
exactly.
Principal
yeah,
way of transportation.
There are costs.
Right.
So they're the ones actually handing out the punishments to people, typically, who violate the agreements about what you can and cannot do in the reserve. The other question was
related to, say, ecotourism or somehow looking at ways to protect the reserve, get people to earn a living, but in a way that isn't destructive to the forest.
Right. So that's part of what they're doing, is they're trying to invite tourists to visit a few of the colonies that exist. There are between, you know, 8 and 14 colonies every winter that come together in very discrete places. And a few of them can be visited by tourists. And so there are efforts to employ locals as tour guides, because you don't want people just showing up in tour buses and wandering up the trails and trampling on butterflies and going off trail. So you want somebody with the tourists. And so that employs some people. We were guided on both of the ventures that we took into the reserve, once on horseback and once on foot. Then there are people, you know, in the parking area who will sell you a meal. You know, you can buy lunch there. People are making art, you know, little earrings and various other things, artisanal stuff about the butterfly that's you can purchase there. So I don't know that's, it's just one small piece mm-hmm. of the puzzle of transitioning the economy there to make it more sustainable. And part of it, too, is, you know, you don't necessarily want to invite hundreds of thousands of people
That's
to
right.
visit this discrete area, you
it's
know?
It's a double-edged sword, really.
Tourism
yes,
often
always.
Is a double-edged sword
right.
when it comes to preserving landscapes and species. So, but that is indeed one of the ways they're trying to do it, is find other ways to employ people other than as, you know, loggers.
Mm-hmm, So, Phil, on other parts of the migration route, are there other efforts to protect habitat or create more habitat for the monarch? Like milkweed, you mentioned earlier, is one of the primary food sources for monarchs, but yet, you know, it's being impacted by pesticides. So, are there efforts in this country to protect monarch habitat?
Yes, there are. I would say the challenges are even greater, actually, in America than they are in Mexico. Mexico, you have a very discrete area. In America, you have a whole flyway that covers the country north-south. So drought in Texas can have an effect on the monarch. We know when it's looking for pollen on its journey northward. Widespread spraying of herbicides on genetically modified crops in the upper Midwest is huge because it's eliminated so much of the milkweed, which is the sole source for the larval stage of the monarch. It needs milkweed to survive. It feasts on milkweed. And by spraying fields, we've just destroyed so much milkweed. You know, millions and millions of acres of monarch habitat have been lost because we're planting corn and soybeans and blanket spraying. So, you know, there's efforts on a small scale to get people to plant milkweed in their gardens and in their yards. There needs to probably be bigger efforts there to preserve bigger chunks of the monarch's habitat in that part of the world.
All right, we'll take a short break and talk more to Phil Connors here on Earth Matters on KURU 89.1 FM. Welcome back to Earth Matters. This is Allison Civic, Director of the Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. My guest today is essayist and author Phil Connors, who earlier this year embarked on a fact-finding trip to Mexico to learn more about the plight of the threatened monarch butterfly. Phil will be heading back up to the fire tower soon for his 14th fire season in the Gila National Forest. So let's shift gears now and talk about fire. This week, March 29th through April 4th, is Southwest Wildfire Awareness Week, and fire season already seems to have started. Gila National Forest fire personnel contained a 25-acre fire last weekend on North Star Mesa, and we've seen small grass fires here in Silver City and Grant County. Phil, tell us what you do as a fire lookout and the importance of this job in fire management in the what has been referred to as the most fire-prone landscape in America.
Yeah, I'm there principally to be an early detection system, part of an early detection system. I'm one of 10 lookouts in the Gila. So we keep watch during daylight hours, and when we spot fires, we try to coordinate with other lookouts to pin down the precise location of them and turn them into the dispatch office in Silver City so that fire managers have as much time and leeway as possible to decide how to react to these fires. If you spot them early, you just give those fire managers more options in how to deal with it. Because often, you know, they'll deal with it by suppressing the fire. And the smaller it is, the easier it is to suppress. In addition to that, we're a communication link for crews working out in the forest. It's a very big, very wild landscape, and crews can often find themselves in places where they can't talk to anyone other than a lookout. They can't talk directly to someone in Silver City at the dispatch office. So we're their link to the outside world. And we also watch weather for them. keep them updated if there's lightning going to be in the area, a storm moving in, if there are sudden wind shifts. These are all things you want to know about if you're on the ground working either on a fire or in some other capacity in the forest and you don't have a view overhead like we have. So early detection, communication, and weather watching are our principal activities.
I think you said in your book, Fire Season, that something like, is it 30,000 lightning strikes in the Gila? I'm wondering, like, are you up in the tower at night, like, keeping track of where all the lightning strikes are, or do you basically just kind of wait until the morning when you can see to see if there are fires?
You know, most of the lightning does happen during daylight hours because
really?
It's a result of influx of moisture and this huge convection effect, which happens with the daytime heating. Yes, there is lightning overnight sometimes. And if there is, I'll often go up in the tower and have a look around to see, you know, generally the area where it's happening. You can't necessarily tell precisely mm-hmm. where. But for the most part, you know, we're off after dark, unless we're talking to a fire crew on the radio, because humidity's higher, the temperature drops, and thus fire risk decreases
okay.
in the evening hours. So it's pretty much a daylight occupation, unless you have somebody on the ground that you're communicating with by radio
okay.
at night.
So I just started to think about lightning and being up in the fire tower. You write about sort of having your hair standing on end, given the electricity up there in the tower sometimes. Is that's got to be an interesting experience, probably pretty scary.
Yeah, people ask me if I ever get afraid up there, like, are you afraid of bears or unruly hikers or, you know, strange visitors? I'm not really afraid of any of those things. The one thing I'm afraid of is lightning, because I'm sitting in a tall metal structure poking up into the sky on the highest spot anywhere around. And so naturally I feel like I'm a lightning rod of sorts when I'm there in that tower. It's grounded, so theoretically one would survive a lightning strike, but I don't. I often bail out when the lightning gets really close, which we are encouraged to do. We can go out of service, turn our radio off. You know, your radio can get fried by a lightning strike if you're in the tower, so they don't want that to happen mm-hmm. either. But yeah, it's a pretty intense experience when you're in the midst of a lightning storm on a mountaintop. It's a close encounter with the incredible power of nature.
Mm-hmm. So Phil, in your book Fire Season, which I encourage our listeners to pick up at the library or purchase, it's a wonderful book. Great read, super interesting. But you recount month by month what happens in the tower from how you're doing your job, what's happening on the ground in terms of fire, and really give the reader a primer on the evolution of the Forest Service's fire management policies. And I recently saw a Forest Service map that showed that half of the Gila National Forest has burned since 1974, which I didn't realize. And the Gila has also been a site of a significant amount of research contributing to the body of science on fire. And so what have we learned about the years of fire suppression on the Gila that you so eloquently write about?
Yeah, we've learned, the first thing we learned was that we live in a fire-adapted ecosystem in this part of the world, that fire is absolutely essential to the health of the place. And as early as the late 70s, early 80s, the Gila was on the very leading edge of an experiment undertaken by the Forest Service to let some fires burn. Because for most of the 20th century, the thinking was fire is evil, fire is destructive, and it needs to be suppressed and kept at bay at all costs to preserve the forest. It took a long time for us to sort of rethink that. But one of the places we rethought it in practice, not just in theory, was on the Gila. Here in the Selway Bitterroot up in Idaho, Montana, they started letting some fires burn back in the late 70s, early 80s, just to see what would happen. And there's been, as you mentioned, significant research done by scientists about fire regimes here. I even went to the University of Arizona Tree Ring Research Laboratory to talk to scientists about what they learned studying tree rings and fire. And so we've learned that this place absolutely needs to burn. And of course, in the age of climate change, it seems that there's nothing we can do to prevent it from burning, in fact. And, you know, we've seen some very large fires in recent years, but it's not necessarily unprecedented to have very large areas of the southwestern forests burn. There's a whole cycle involving stand replacement where one species becomes mature, it burns and starts a cycle that it starts over with something else. Like, say, in the high country, you have spruce and fir. That'll burn in a big stand replacement fire, and then it gets replaced by something like aspen, which takes hold for, you know, 50, 100 years, and then it becomes decadent and or burns. If it becomes decadent, it provides, that window of opportunity of shade and moisture for the mixed conifer to come back again. So over time, we've really learned that we need fire if we're going to keep this place healthy. We can't exclude fire and keep it healthy. If we exclude fire, we'll be doing the opposite of keeping it healthy.
Mm-hmm. So where you are in the Black Range, was it last year? I'm trying to remember the fire last year.
It was two years ago.
So you've had one season up there since the fire, is that
correct?
Right? Okay, what's the recovery been like, and what have you seen? What are some of the changes that you've seen?
Well, it's fascinating to live someplace for 11 or 12 summers as I did, and then see it transformed in a period of weeks, the summer of 2013, the Silver Fire, and then go back and live inside of a giant burn scar, 200 square miles we're talking about here, in the south half of the Black Range, basically burned. And part of what you see is just the incredible resilience of nature. It's a very traumatic thing to see huge smoke plumes, blackened trees, and a fire of that magnitude. It sort of acts like a wound on our psyche almost, because we have deep attachments to those places. At least I did, and I know a lot of other people did, a deep attachment to the way it looked for a long, long time. And then overnight, practically, it changes. But it's sort of encouraging to see what comes back after a fire. The aspen regeneration has been tremendous up in the high country, especially on north slopes. There's going to be way more aspen than there was before. Oak comes back very, very quickly, just resprouts. And so, you know, the old saying, nature abhors a vacuum. Yeah, the landscape might blacken briefly, but something comes back. There's very few parts of that burn scar that are just totally devoid of vegetation. It's recovering. It's going to be a slow process, of course, but it's really interesting to see a place transformed and come back as something different, and I've been able to witness that.
Right, and I'm wondering, the Forest Service is doing monitoring, right, to see how the forest is recovering from these stand replacement fires. Is that happening in the area that you cover?
Yeah, the Gila, between our two big fires, Whitewater Baldy in 2012 and the Silver Fire in 2013, we're the perfect laboratory to study what happens after big fires, and people are doing it. Scientists are doing it. I'm even lucky enough to be doing it on a very small scale myself, because I had a big trove of photographs taken before the fire of various places around my lookout. Just, you know, I was basically shooting scenery, I thought, at the time. You do that for 10 years. You take many hundreds, if not thousands, of pictures. And then the landscape becomes transformed. I had this record of before the fire, and so now I've been going out at the end of every season after the rains and taking pictures, matching up, trying to match up precisely what I had before in the before pictures, just to show the changes before and after. And then I hope to make it an ongoing thing where I revisit those same sites summer after summer and see how the regrowth happens and what the fuel changes are. And hopefully that'll be an important part of the historical record over time, so we can see how this landscape evolves with fire.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. Okay, we'll take a short break and talk more to Phil Connors here on Earth Matters on KURU 89.1 FM. Back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Simic, and I'm your host for today's program. Let's continue talking with essayist and author Phil Connors. He's heading back soon to his wilderness lookout in the Black Range for his 14th fire season. Phil, in your second book, All the Wrong Places, you write about your relationship with your brother Dan and coming to terms with his suicide. And this event in your life led to you making your home here in New Mexico and becoming a fire lookout. What drew you to the Gila?
Well, it was a friend's invitation that drew me to the Gila in the very beginning. A friend of mine from college, MJ, she and I had been at the University of Montana together, and she wrote to me when I was living in New York City and told me about getting a job as a fire lookout in the Gila and, you know, said, basically, get your flabby, pasty self out from behind that computer screen, out of the cubicle, and come visit. Breathe some fresh air for a change. And I had been making trips to Albuquerque over the years because that is where my brother had lived in the last years of his life and ultimately died there, just seeking out people who had known him, trying to puzzle out some of the mystery of his suicide. And on those trips, I always tried to do something else that wasn't death-haunted or just focused on him, something that, you know, nourished me in some way. And so I often went hiking or backpacking or hanging out in hot springs and things like that. And on this particular trip, I decided to combine those two things, visit some people in Albuquerque, and then come down and see MJ in the Gila. And so when I was in Albuquerque, I learned some sort of new revelations about my brother and his life, and something that actually put his death in a new context. And when I left Albuquerque carrying this new knowledge south, I just had a sense that something had changed for me, and I wasn't sure I could go back to New York City and just pretend that everything was unchanged. I had a lot to think about concerning him and his death. And bless her heart, my friend MJ recognized this fact, and during the 3 days I spent visiting her at her fire tower in the Black Range of the Gila, she came around to the idea that she would pass the torch to me and basically make a gift of her mountain and her job and hand it over and allow me the time and space in which to think about what I had learned in Albuquerque and how to move forward. So that's kind of how it played out. It was a lucky break, the luckiest break of my life. I went back to New York, promptly quit my job, and came back to the Gila, and I've spent every summer there since.
All right, you say in your book, Fire Season, that you have to be free of a whole long list of fears. You sort of mentioned that a little bit previously, fear of fire, heights, steep slopes and stairs, being forgotten, the dark, wild animals, many, many more, long list of them here. And you recount that every season there are one or two lookouts that throw in the towel after a day or two because perhaps they can't deal with some of these fears. And you also mentioned that as a lookout, you're paid to master the art of solitude. So what's it like to be by yourself in the lookout tower and probably have to get over maybe some of those fears, or hopefully you don't have any of those fears, although you have a fear of lightning, you said.
Yeah, I suppose that's innate in human beings.
Right.
You know, when you hear that loud concussive blast nearby, you can't help but cringe a little bit. And so, you know, I take measures to deal with that and to try to limit my exposure to lightning strikes. I don't stand out in the meadow on my mountaintop with a giant metal pole in my hand when there's a lightning storm. And I try to bail out of the fire tower when lightning happens nearby. But, you know, I think that kind of solitude is something that you can learn to enjoy. It's like anything, with practice. When I first showed up there and was plucked out of the megalopolis of New York City and dropped into the Aldo Leopold Wilderness, it was a bit of a sensory shock. I was accustomed to endless sensory stimulation in New York City. And over time, I learned that there are many sensory stimuli and sensory experiences available to a person hanging out on a mountaintop if you know where to look and how to find them and what it is you're living amidst. But at first, it was really, really difficult just because it was so radically different than the life I had lived beforehand. But for me, it's become vital to my creative life. Inside that solitude, I can access parts of myself and parts of my creative self that I just can't necessarily access in the day-to-day grind of internet connections and bills to pay and errands to run. So sitting quietly in one place for a really long time, it may not be the most natural human impulse, but over time, with practice, I've managed to bend it to my advantage and to be creative there and to read a lot and to write and to cook and just to sit and do nothing. Part of being, I think, a creative person is all the hours of just sitting and maybe waiting for something to happen, waiting for an insight to flit across your vision. And so that's part of the creative process for me, too, just that sitting there and waiting.
Yeah, you quote Norman MacLean in your book as writing, "It doesn't take much in the way of body and mind to be a lookout. It's mostly soul." Do you agree with MacLean's summation? And what do you think about that after 13 years up in the tower?
No, I think that's fairly accurate. You know, you have to be at least moderately physically capable, in my case, because I have to hike 5 miles to get there. But if you can do that, and you can read maps, and work a two-way radio, and know which end of the binoculars to look through, you can pretty much do the job. It's not that hard. I think Edward Abbey once said, any literate anthropoid with an IQ above about 80 can be taught how to be a lookout in less than 2 hours. And that, too, seems right to me. I think it's about finding comfort in your own skin, making peace with your own company, being able to withstand long hours of watching while nothing happens. That's, I think, something that MacLean hints at is, you know, it is more about soul and paying attention and learning to have a sixth sense about when there's fire danger and when there's not, than it is about any sort of intellectual activity or physical activity. Because, you know, for the most part, when I'm doing my job, I'm essentially just sitting and staring out the window and getting paid for it. In the 21st century, which I never fail to get a chuckle out of that I can get paid to look out the window at mountains all day.
Yeah, great. So Are you looking forward to heading back up to the Lookout Tower? Will you be working on a new book or a new writing project this season?
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to doing the job again and getting there, because I just came off a book tour, which was rather grueling, 4,000 miles through 5 states, and talking night after night about, you know, suicide and the saddest thing that ever happened in my life. I can't recommend it as the surest route to peace, tranquility, and bodily relaxation. So it'll be really nice to get there and to just sort of sit in one place for a while and decompress from all that. And hopefully when I do that, the creative well will start to fill again, because I really feel as though this recent book about my brother and my life in the aftermath of his death really sort of emptied the well for me. It was really hard to get right. It took a really long time to get it done right. And I haven't even felt like writing much for the last 6 months or so. And I think that once I get back to the Lookout and sit quietly, I can access again those creative impulses. What will I work on? That's a good question, because I don't really know. I would like to write something about the monarch. You know, something, a lot has been written about its endangered migration, the numerous threats to it. I'd like to try to find a way to write something a little bit more personal, just from my perspective of now having grown up on the northern end of the migration, visited the southern end of the migration, been involved in a very tangible way in harming it as a kid, as we talked about earlier. In some ways, going to Mexico this January was a kind of a journey of atonement. You know, I wanted to go there, and it's not as if I can have a conversation with butterflies and tell them, I'm sorry for what I did to your habitat in the early 80s in southern Minnesota. But I did want to kind of make some sort of offering of some sort. And part of it maybe is just telling that story and trying to understand its story, because its story is so incredible. Just the length of the migration and the multiple generations and the amount of ground it covers and various habitats that it moves through. It is, you know, easily one of the most incredible, impressive natural spectacles on planet Earth. And I'm hoping I'll have a little time and energy to sift through my thoughts on all that and make something out of it.
Great. So, Phil, in the last couple minutes remaining in the show, do you think you'll ever return back to writing about water issues, a topic that you sort of delved into on the Arizona Water Settlements Act over the last 6 months? What do you think? You think you'll ever get back into that topic?
You know, I'd like to. It's a question of finding a way in. The challenges are so enormous in our part of the world. The stories are very difficult and many of them quite sad. The Rio Grande is a case in point. I've done some research on the Rio Grande, and man, I'm not sure I can live inside that sad of a story for the length of time it would require to write a book. The Gila issue is, of course, still of interest to me, and I'll be following developments there because, as you know better than just about anybody, it's an ongoing story and will be for years to come. So I'll be paying attention and hopefully figuring out ways to write about it in ways that are illuminating and hopefully productive.
That's great. Well, Phil, thanks so much for speaking with us today on Earth Matters. And that's all the time we have. Thank you to our audio engineer, Kyle Johnson. We hope you'll join us again for next week's edition of Earth Matters here on Gila Members Community Radio 89.1 FM.